Hi guys, it's Annie McDonald, physio and strength and conditioning coach, and welcome to the Informed Performance podcast. On today's show, I have the pleasure of speaking to David Gray, a rehab coach based in Ireland, who has delivered programs to over 20,000 people worldwide, and therefore had an incredible impact on many athletes' lives, rehab, health and performance. On today's show, myself and David will mainly be chatting about foot and Achilles function with a few tangents along the way. If you're listening to this episode and you're a physio or physical therapist wanting to upskill your strength and conditioning education, or perhaps you're a strength and conditioning coach wanting to learn more about injury-specific approaches, then definitely check out our new Strength and Conditioning for Rehab Professionals course online. As we know, clinical education does not cover high-performance sport, and typically, strength and conditioning education does not cover rehab. So to bridge this knowledge gap, myself and seven expert presenters have created a course that covers essential and in-depth S&T topics in a rehab context that you can apply with your athletes and their rehab process immediately. The course includes expert contributions from an amazing lineup including Matt Jordan, Ben Ashworth, Dan Howes, Jonas Dodu, Eric Mira, Scott Morrison and Jesse Wright. So if you're looking for a more applied and contextual place to learn about strength and conditioning for a rehab purpose, then join us on this online course. This episode has been sponsored by Vol Performance, makers of ForceDex, the world's fastest, easiest and most powerful dual force plate system. ForceDex can help you to analyse neuromuscular strength, performance and imbalances in your athletes. With an incredibly simple setup and intuitive software, ForceDex automatically detects over 15 common force plate tests and analyzes them with a single click, helping you to collect quick and accurate insights on your athletes. To learn more, head over to our sponsor, VolPerformance.com. You're listening to the Informed Performance podcast with me, Annie McDonald, and here is today's guest, David Gray. David, welcome to the show, mate. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Hey, Andy, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to the chat.
And, you know, we always begin by getting people to explain their background. I first came across you online because you put out some really good content. But just in case somebody hasn't come across you just yet, can you kind of walk us through who you are, what you do, and what's brought you to where you are now?
I'll be nice and quick. It's kind of the boring part for probably everyone, but maybe for me as well. You get very sick of talking about yourself after a while, after a podcast. So I am in Ireland. I'm based in Waterford in Ireland. It's about 2 hours south of Dublin. And our team works primarily in the rehab space. That kind of was born out of me being an athlete myself and being injured quite a bit and just being a little bit frustrated, or to be honest, very, very frustrated over the years around the care that I received. And it's probably the same as most people's stories in this industry. You end up trying to figure a little bit out for yourself and learning from other people and stuff. So, at this stage now, long story short, we have a little bit of a team here. We have kind of two parts to our business. Part one, maybe three parts to our business, depending on how you want to cut it up. But we have one part is just coaching, working with people, rehabbing them. Primarily very active people. We get a lot of really good athletes, but not just athletes. I really like working with athletes, but not just athletes. I like working with active people, people who just want to train, want to be able to go for a run or play tennis or do whatever, not necessarily professional or anything like that. We get a lot of those type of people, and then we get a lot of like really good athletes, elite athletes from different sports around the world. And I like working with both. And actually, you start to realize that it's more similar than different, I think. It's just that the elite athletes adapt that little bit quicker. But they don't usually need that much different things, I don't think, to be honest. Or maybe that's my bias, at least. So that's one part of our business is that. We also have like an online presence, which has like DIY programs that people can buy for certain issues. And that's, I guess, another part of the business, which is you don't get contact with us or our team, really, not too much, but you can go away and work on your own. And then the third part is the education side of things. So we have a couple of different parts. We have a membership site where we have about 1,000 coaches and therapists on there, and they learn with us every week, short, sharp videos on different topics. And then we kind of travel around and teach workshops around the world, which is kind of on pause at the moment because I just had a new little baby, my first baby. So yeah, so that's I guess a very quick background into what we do, and we pride ourselves on getting really good results. Everything that we have built, even the education stuff, it's all built off trying to get really good results with people, trying to be good practitioners, good coaches, good physios for some of our team, and just being good people as well. Just trying to not be dickheads. There's a lot of dickheads in the industry, and I've learned that if you are one of those, like if you can make a, you can kind of make a bit of a wave online, and you can be a bit of an asshole, but what you end up attracting is those type of people as well. So we're steering more towards just doing really good work, trying to be good people, and having fun along the way. Yeah. So I guess that's hopefully a decent insight.
I'd be really curious to sort of learn about how your, what I perceive to be your style of working with people kind of evolve. So when I started as a strength coach, my mentor had formerly been an osteo, and he always kind of fostered this, I guess, love and very integrated application of anatomy into how I think around coaching, cueing, technique, exercise selection in a really in-depth way. And that's still sort of the big tool that I think I use in my arsenal. And I think I perceive you to have a similar approach for that, a kind of appreciation for truly what anatomy is doing and how you get the most out of it. Can you kind of maybe explain where that came from and how that shaped for you?
Yeah. I think I always had an interest in just movement. From being a child, I can remember just looking at people moving and playing sport and just kind of being a little bit fascinated in terms of how they move versus sometimes how I moved, which wasn't always a great thing for me. But I think I've been lucky enough, like yourself, to probably have good teachers and mentors over the years who have started to teach movement and rehab and just coaching, and starting from a first principle of like, okay, we have a body, we have our certain anatomy, it's set up in a certain way for a certain reason, we have different types of muscles running in different directions, here's the shape of our bones. And I like to have a respect for that to begin with. I also have a respect for the individual in front of me, that they have layered on top of their anatomy, is not layered on top of it, but with it is all their thoughts and fears and beliefs and emotions and an injury history and a training history and all of this stuff. So we try and take a quite like holistic view of looking at people, even though that word now has been pretty much butchered. So for want of a better word, we just try and look at a little bit of everything. And I think, yeah, my teachers over the years had a respect for anatomy and an understanding that, like, if we can just restore the body, help it make certain shapes, help the bones move in certain ways, help understand, okay, the joint, this joint is actually, it has developed, and these are the movements that it can and hopefully should have access to. If we restore that, I have a lot of trust in the body that, okay, you're missing this. I'm not saying it's the answer to all your problems, but maybe if we restore that movement, you did probably have it at one stage. Along the way, you lost it for whatever reason. Let's restore it along with doing other things. Let's just restore that. Let's get that anatomy moving. Let's get the bones moving, which are going to pull on muscles, which will help load the tissue and sense the tissues in a different way, or the area in a different way. I have a lot of trust in the body, I guess, and trust starts with understanding the anatomy and being able to see movement and coach movement. And yeah, I think that's a really fun way of looking at the body.
Yeah, I think I don't know about you, I get quite frustrated with the sort of binary arguments that exist about, you know, what position should the spine be when you squat? Does it relate to pain? Or if you have your knee slightly rotated during a squat, how does that transfer when you tackle somebody in a rugby field? Because it's too fast, you can't think about it in real time. There's all these kind of quite binary arguments. But then I kind of always come back to, in my mind, if you're in the gym and you're doing a squat or whatever the exercise is, it's deliberate practice, where why would you not try and do it as well as you can and not shortcut optimizing whatever you can anatomically, wherever it is in that chain. I don't know how you see that.
Yeah, I see it similar. I guess it comes back to your model of movement here. And it's like, okay, what is the goal? If you're choosing a squat to do with someone, is the goal to lift the most amount of weight possible? Is it to load certain joints in certain ways? Is it to cause hypertrophy or strength or whatever? So if you talk about something like a spine, let's say, okay, if your model involves, okay, we are trying to load your hips and your knees in particular and the muscles around that in a squat, then I would like to see maybe the least amount of spine movement possible in a squat. But that argument that online ends up with people saying, so you're saying that the spine shouldn't move or that it's not robust or it's not strong. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying if you have a goal of X, then potentially doing Y is a good thing. There's also times, so it does come back to the anatomy and it does come back to your worldview and your view of the body overall, which is, do you actually believe the body is robust or not? Do you believe it can adapt or not? And for a lot of people, the answer is no. I would say we need our spine to be able to move in all different ways. And I also have a model, which is I want to see like a really quiet spine in certain movements where you're actually not really moving your spine at all or very little in certain movements. I think those two things can coexist. And that's not what you see online a whole lot of the time, which, yeah, I'm with you. That can be quite frustrating, I think.
Yeah. Inform Performance is proudly partnered with Team Builder, a strength and conditioning software for performance coaches that is full of tools to help support you in your daily role. Whether it's building programs, tracking workout progress, or monitoring athlete wellness, load management, and fatigue, they've got you covered. Head to teambuilder.com and sign up with promo code INFORM to start your 30-day free trial. One of the big things I want to talk to you about today is foot function, and then we'll probably get onto Achilles a bit later. The foot for me always seems to be one of those areas where you see some practitioners that really enjoy thinking and considering how they train the foot. And then for other people, it could be the place where they, you know, get some pick-up marbles between their toes and that exhausts the program. What are the sort of athletic qualities that you consider at the foot and ankle that maybe are overlooked by practitioners?
Overlooked.
What are they missing? What are the kind of things that you think maybe people miss in their training here?
I think that when we look at the foot or any part of the body, so there's a lot of joints in the foot to begin with. So when we look at any part of the body, and particularly a part of the body where there is joints should equal movement potential. We're starting to think about, can the foot or this part of the body actually change shape? Can it experience change? When the foot starts to change shape, you're going to start to load tissues in a different way. You're going to have tissues that are lengthening and tissues that are shortening, either on the bottom of the foot, the top of the foot, the inside, the outside, and so on. So I think that if you think about feet, especially in the rehab space, I'm just going to stick there, but it applies to coaches as well. When we look at, when you have someone with an ankle injury, like an Achilles injury, or I won't say injury, a problem, an issue, a plantar fascia, whatever, usually people are going to look at a couple of things. They're going to look at a calf raise, number one. They're going to, not number one, but one of the things they look at is a calf raise. Another one is a knee to wall drill, usually, and potentially some kind of like big toe dorsiflexion or lift or squeeze or something like this. None of those actually look at if the foot can change shape. You can drive your knee forward and back over your ankle as far as possible, knee to wall, and experience no movement at the actual foot itself outside of the ankle. If you think about moving the ankle joint, you're moving through a very small, you're moving through a select area, maybe a lot, but you're missing out on a whole lot of movement potential at the foot. So what I think about, when what I think people miss massively is taking a step back, don't look at always at global range of motion, like how far can you get your knee forward. That's not the only consideration that you should have. You should also look at how much are all of these areas actually experiencing movement, or are they experiencing movement at all. We can get into the weeds with that in terms of like the different joints and pronation and supination and all of this stuff, but when I'm teaching courses and we talk about the foot, number one, I try to get everyone, people to strip back all the language, because it can get a little bit complex. And I start with, when this person does X movement, does the foot change shape? Are you seeing change there? And I think that's a very simple way to start looking at things. And we do look at that with regards to a neck. If you had a neck client, you would start by asking them, potentially, like, to, can you move your head around, and is there relative motion happening at the neck? I can move my head around in space by locking my head onto my rib cage, onto my spine, and turning everything as one chunk. I can move my head around in space without actually experiencing any movement at the neck itself, relative in the joints relative to each other. You can move your foot around in space by rolling your foot to the inside, which some people call pronation, or rolling it to the outside, which some people call supination. Neither of those things are pronation or supination. That is inversion and eversion of the foot, unless joints within the foot are moving relative to other joints. So my start point is, no matter where it is in the body, when I'm talking about movement, is movement actually occurring? Is something here changing shape? And I think that's almost completely overlooked, to be honest, which is wild to me. It's not overlooked in other areas of the body. It's definitely overlooked within the foot.
Yeah, beyond the knee to wall. what things make up your assessment of let's say the foot, if you're in person, let's say, just to make it a bit easier?
Yeah, it would be the same online, to be honest. For the most part, the difference would be, sometimes in person, I would get someone to lie on the table and have a little poke around, just have a little feel. I like to, if I am going hands-on, just to have a feel, I'll do three big things. I'll cup the calcaneus and just wiggle it around. I call it calcaneus wiggle. You can check, like, okay, does the heel bone itself, separate to other things, can it dorsiflex and plantar flex and invert and evert and rotate? You can kind of get a check of that. I don't need to feel that too much. I call it calcaneus wiggle. Can I wiggle the heel bone around in my hand a little bit? That's one. The second one would be getting my thumbs in between the head and the metatarsals and just poking around there. Can I get like some separation in between those metatarsals? And then the third one would probably be like big toe in particular, dorsiflexion and plantar flexion or extension. Particularly extension there. Now, that does give you some information, but really what helps the foot change shape is not short foot exercises, those can be fine, everything can be fine, but what helps the foot change shape is our body weight coming onto the foot. It is the weight of our body pushing into the foot, which pushes the foot into the floor. That's what helps the foot change shape. So when I start to look at can the foot change shape, I'll usually just get someone to stand up, pop their, let's say, their right foot slightly in front, a very short lunge, like a knee to wall type of position, and I'll just ask them to slowly bring their knee forward and back. I'm interested but I don't care that much how far forward and how far back they can get. I'm looking at, when they come forward, do they experience some pronation? And when they come back out of that position, do they experience some supination? If they can do that, we're also checking dorsiflexion and plantar flexion, but we're looking at much more than just the ankle. So that's a massive assessment of mine. If I just wanted to see the foot, how it moves, I would just go into that split position and just ask them to bring their knee forward and back 5 times, and you can start to see so much going on there, so much stuff going on there. So yeah, apart from that, I'll look at full body movements there, which is kind of like how they manage their center of mass. So just a squat, a toe touch, rotation, standing rotation, you just twist left and right, you'll actually see some nice movement at the feet there as well, potentially. Lateral flexion of the spine, like side bends. Yeah, those are the global movements that I'll do with everyone, but you're able to pick up like how they organize and how they move around and see what's happening at the foot. But if I'm just honing in on the foot itself, that one position, that knee forward and back, you can see so much from just that. You just kind of have to know what to look for, I think.
Yeah, if we kind of bucket that into common themes of maybe available range of movement and maybe motor control, what can they actually control through range too? Are you looking at sort of isolated strength capacities as well at the foot?
Not really, initially at least. It depends on what the issue is. It depends what, because for me, right, when I train people, when I rehab people, firstly, I'm just going to look at range of motion, right? Let's just see where you can get to. As we go along, we're going to end up training the foot in so many ways anyway. And if there has been an issue present, I know they're just kind of just going to be a little bit weak anyway. So I usually just start with the low hanging fruit. I won't really try and isolate anything too much in particular. The one thing I might isolate is like, which isn't even isolation, but I'll do a calf raise. If I'm like, I do want to see you doing a calf raise and see if you can do a calf raise and how strong you are and what positions and so on. So that is something I will look at. I don't usually go too much into the, you know, isolated toe flexor strength or anything like that. It's not that I'm against it or anything. I just don't think it's usually not the low-hanging fruit, unless, of course, they've had an injury directly to the toe itself, in which case, then I would do that.
Yeah, cool. And then is there, again, this is void of context, so I don't need to sort of just say off the shelf, this is what I do every time, but in terms of training the foot and ankle, we'll come to Achilles next, but in terms of training the foot and ankle complex, is there things that make up key training considerations for you, or areas and movements perhaps that you're like, I want to make sure I develop this capacity or this type of thing?
Yeah, there is. Yeah. So we'll be working on usually like pronation, supination in the beginning, which comes along with dorsiflexion and plantar flexion. So just opening up some range of motion in a very gentle way. We're actually looking for the least amount of I'm not trying to get you to really pull yourself forward or pull yourself back. It's about, these things work much better when you start to understand that your best dorsiflexor in the closed chain, when your foot is on the floor, when your foot is in the air, you're going to be using tibialis anterior and all this stuff. When your foot is on the floor, your best dorsiflexor is gravity. Gravity is what dorsiflexes you. All you need to do is unlock your knee. Your shin will hopefully just keep dropping forward in that direction. And that shin drop is what is going to bring you towards the middle of your foot, your knee, your center of mass. It's going to pressurize the foot. It's going to load the plantar fascia, the soleus, basically all the muscles around your ankle in some way or another. So the first thing I want to make sure is that you can actually drop your shin forward. You can unlock your knee and let your shin drop forward. That's so important. Early stage rehab, so important. Mid stage rehab, so important. Late stage rehab, so important. Like if you're ending up getting someone in a acceleration position or into a broad jump or anything like that, the setup, the place that people are going to be pushing from is like, I'm dropping my shin and then I'm going to push from there. In the strength and conditioning world, historically at least, we've been obsessed with like triple extension, pushing out of positions. But I think that kind of happens naturally to, in my opinion, a lot of the time. People struggle with getting there in the first place. So making sure they can drop their shin forward is absolutely key. from there, it's you're helping people get to on top of their midfoot and their mid to forefoot. That's where we push a lot from, not just on the toes, where we're high on the toes. A lot of our push comes from where we're just in on that midfoot, where we're mid to forefoot pressure, and we can really drive through the floor there. So we'll be doing that from early on, usually in a variety of, like, even bridges lying on our back, calf bridges, foam roller bridges and stuff like that. It might sound quite simple and, like, basic and remedial to some people listening, until they actually try it and they realize they can't do 5 seconds of a foam roller bridge. It's very different to a hamstring bridge or something like that. It's you're actually getting the forefoot involved, and you're getting this, like, synergistic contraction of the calves and the hamstrings and potentially some glute as well. So dropping the shin forward, pressurizing the foot, learning to push through the foot, and then delaying knee extension is another one. Hopefully I'm not going too fast here, but once we can actually drop the shin forward, which allows us to transition from a negative shin angle where our knee is behind our ankle to a positive shin angle where our knee is in front of our ankle. Now we're starting to transition. We're starting to pronate our foot. We're starting to get on top of our foot. This is where we push from. If your weight is back and you push from your heel, you're not going anywhere. You're not on top of your foot. So getting people on top of their foot first, which involves having a bit of range of motion, a bit of space at the ankle and the foot, dropping the shin forward, positive shin angle, push from here. When we learn to push from this position, very hard, which is like plantar flexing very hard through the floor, but from a dorsiflexed position, we're hopefully starting to, like, integrate. You hear a lot of people online talking about foot to hip connection or foot to glute connection, and it's so vague and stuff. But, like, if you ask people what does that mean, like, they don't know because it's just being made up. But if you, in our workshops, we kind of get into this a little bit more. And it can still be vague. I appreciate that. But if you're on top of your foot, you have a positive shin angle, and you push down through your foot and your knee extends, then that knee extension pushes you backwards on your foot a little bit. And it does put you into more hip extension, if that makes sense. So you're on top of your foot. You have a slightly bent knee. And you straighten your knee, you've gone into hip extension there, but it's your quadriceps that have done it and it's pushed you backwards. So instead, we try and teach a lot of people to get in on top of their foot and try and keep their knee in a flex position for longer, and do things like hinges and do things like squats and all that stuff, where as you come back up out of those positions, you're keeping your knee forward, you're staying in a positive shin angle, and this allows you to get a much more active hip extension. So you come all the way up and through and you're using your hip muscles, but along the same time, you're using your foot driving through the floor. So when we start to progress on with our exercises and our rehab protocols and stuff that we use, so much of it is done in a positive shin angle. You're not allowed to come back out of there. You have to stay in there. You're doing a lot of stuff where you're in on top of your foot throughout. You're not coming in and out all of the time, although that's a good option too. And we're staying in a positive shin angle. We're trying to delay knee extension and drive a lot of hip movement from there. The cool thing is now we're just training. This is like almost full body training exercises, but done in a specific way so that you'll actually feel the foot and the soleus and everything else around the ankles working incredibly hard, and we're not necessarily needing to just have specific isolation exercises for that all the time. So I know I've gone all over the place there now, but hopefully that's somewhat clear to someone.
It was perfect. You saved me fumbling my words, because I wanted to talk to you about the, you know, the foot hip axis, whatever you want to call it, the connection between the two things. And while you were talking, I was thinking, I really wanted to talk about this just before you did. And you acknowledged it's really hard to actually describe what it is. And I was like, great, now I don't have to ask the question. I think it's interesting, because I think years ago we all gravitated towards things like FMS. And I don't criticize that at that moment in time, because there wasn't that many other things out there. It was hard to get more isolated, objective measures on things that you're trying to test beyond things on the table. And now I think we've maybe as a trend drifted towards being way better, driven by hardware, at testing isolated capacities, ranges, things like that, because the tools are now at our disposal. Yep. But I think our attention has drifted away from kind of like you described in certain positions where you look at both the foot and the hip and how one affects the other in terms of the movement, the force production, and just the skill of the movement itself. So no, I appreciate you talking about that. It's a really, I think it's worryingly becoming an overlooked thing about you address one thing in the body and you're not considering how it links to other areas at the same time.
Yeah.
In an applied way.
Well, look, we're at the end of the day, we are, regardless of your title or your, like, yeah, your history of education, you're also a coach. What you do is you coach movement. And funnily enough, so many coaches don't want to coach anymore. There's this weird idea now, which, like, the idea of self-organization has come into the industry. It's a really good thing. It's understanding how our nervous system organizes and how it's not a top-down approach, and it's not a, like, okay, the brain is the boss of everything. No, it's like all of these tissues and short loop and blah 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 blah. There's so much going on, but now the idea has started to spill into the world, which is like, just let them self-organize. It's their nervous system will choose the best thing for them. And I'm like, the person saying that, have you worked with anyone? Have you seen how people will move? And especially post-injury, how they will move. They will do everything possible to avoid loading the tissues that have been sensitized or injured or they believe are not safe or whatever. We as coaches, that's what we are. When we're coaching, when we are working with people, we are a coach. You are coaching them to improve in ways that they possibly wouldn't be able to do on their own. Time is a factor. Time, people will improve with time, hopefully, as long as they're exercising, but we can help them improve so much faster. But we have to actually look at movement and see what they are avoiding. I've seen a lot of people that, yes, they can go to they can go and do a test, and testing is important. I get the right clients to go and do the right testing at the right times. It's valuable information. But so often there's a discrepancy between what you see in the test and what you see actually within movement, which is, okay, you have an ability to your max voluntary contraction, you can ramp that up, but the skill of movement isn't just a max voluntary contraction. How hard can you push it? When do you push? It's where do you push from? It's when do you decide that the push is over? When the push should start? That is the skill of movement. The testing that we're doing is just like, a lot of the time, how hard can you push for how long? But that is not the skill of movement. That is a skill in itself. That is an important skill, and we want to improve those qualities, but we have to look at movement and we have to coach movement, particularly with people whose jobs it is to move, who are playing sports and stuff like that, or just want to move well. We have to look at it. If you try and let them figure it out on their own, it's not nearly as good as what you think it is.
I definitely see it as one of those statements and kind of arguments in the pendulum where it's kind of swung one way and now it's overcorrecting the other. And I think, like, you know, you take a sport like, let's say, rowing, a really closed skill sport. It's a race, there's other competitors and things like that. But for the most part, let's just say it's pretty closed. Why can't you put somebody in a certain position, let them experience how their force production feels in a sport where they can be intentional, deliberate, conscious of all those things, and then hopefully be able to develop the capacity to do it over a series of repetitions, which is the race.
Yeah.
I don't know. It reminds me of the kind of footwear argument of, you know, really cushioned shoes, really minimalist shoes, maybe somewhere in the middle is a good compromise. It seems like one of those arguments that's maybe yet to find its maturity, just in my very, very opinionated position on it.
Yeah, I think it's often coming from people online who either aren't working with people, have stopped working with people, are miscategorizing how they work with people. They're saying, oh, we only do this way. But if you were to sit in on a session, it's like, that is not what you're saying you do. It's very, very different. So, yeah, I don't know. I just can't see how not looking at movement and coaching movement can't be important. What I will say is, there's, like, first of all, I know some people will maybe listen to this podcast or will listen to this stuff online, and they'll say, okay, I'm working with an obese person. I don't care how they squat. It's just that their fact that they're squatting. 100%. I am not saying that, like, move. Let's look at movement quantity as well. First off, some people are not moving enough. Some people are moving too much. We need to deal with movement quantity, but movement variety is really important. Movement options are really important. Movement variability is really important. And those are things that we can have a massive influence as well. And those are areas that you can, and movement patterns are really important. You can solve, if you are a good practitioner, you can solve problems that other people cannot solve in the industry, which makes you a much more valuable practitioner in the industry when you can actually, you can not just deal with, okay, oh, right, you are training 4 days a week. That's too much. Now you can train 3 days a week. You, me, so many other people have athletes that you have to train 4 days a week. You're this is what is happening, and I'm going to give you the tools or help you develop the tools so that you can tolerate those 4 days. And that's not always just building more strength. That can be, okay, let's just open up some movement options. So now you can spread the load. It's the same amount of load going into your system, but you're able to disperse it and spread it across more areas, which allows you to tolerate load. So doing things like this allows you to solve problems that others can't solve, which makes you much more valuable to the industry, I think. I think it's really important.
Yeah, 100%. To kind of bounce back a little bit to sort of foot and ankle, one of the things I want to talk to you about is Achilles function, because I know that's something that you present and talk about. And there's a gradual and kind of increasingly large recognition at the moment of foot and ankle forces during running change of direction in recent years. And then add to that how prolific calf Achilles injuries are in sports, and the fact that we can now better profile them in terms of force capacities using, you know, force decks, force frames, whatever the tool is. I'm aware that a lot of the content you put out has a particular theme of movement competency and quality. As it kind of pertains to the Achilles itself, how do you look at movement quality and competency there? So we don't, and then let's kind of not talk about how strong the calf needs to be for a healthy Achilles, blah, 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 blah. Let's just kind of go into what you maybe look at from a movement skill perspective.
Yeah, good question. So I'll use an example of a client that I had the other day. So I had an elite athlete. He's about 28, so like prime of his career, and he's had an Achilles tendinopathy for 3 years. And he's been doing calf raises for 3 years. a lot of athletes will recognize this cycle, which is like when I got this problem in the beginning, I started doing calf raises. It helped me a little bit, and then they just became part of my routine, and I've been doing the same thing for years, but it never got better than that certain point. And I appreciate that a tendinopathy can be very, very tricky, especially for athletes that are playing their sport quite a lot. But we actually looked at how he was doing his calf raises when he was down with me. First, we did the assessments that I was speaking about earlier, which was the pronation, supination, that knee forward, knee back. And he actually had very little ability to change shape at his foot whatsoever, which that is like number one for me. Let's actually open up some space here. And then I looked at how he was doing his calf raises, and he was actually being cued, not just that he was doing this on his own, but he was being cued to make sure to initiate the push in a calf raise with his toes and squeeze his toes down. And when I took that away from him, and he was getting like cramping in his foot and his anterior shin and his lateral shin, and not really feeling like a nice juicy contraction in the soleus, you know, it was kind of always lateral, medial, like kind of stringy parts and stuff like this. And what was fatiguing for him was like the outside of his shin, which just doesn't really make sense. Like if I was doing a bicep curl and my and my, I don't know, some kind of, I don't know, posterior deltoid or something was fatiguing. Like, there's something to look at there. And when we kind of took away a lot of that stuff and taught him how to truly plantar flex, which is driven from calf shortening, not just like you're distorting at the forefoot and the metatarsals are pushing down and all that stuff. Got him up into the top of a double leg calf raise, switched him into a single leg, like I said, hold that position, and he dropped like an inch. He couldn't hold that position at all without having a huge contribution from the toes and also his center of mass starting to drive forward. And to me, that's insane. Like, that's someone who's already a strong person. He's already an elite athlete, and he's been doing calf raises for 3 years, and he can't get to the top of it. This isn't someone who ruptured his Achilles. It's just a tendinopathy. So it's not like he's wasted away and atrophied and all that much. So we spent that session teaching him how to plantar flex, which is coming from getting movement at the ankle joint and getting movement at the heel bone. So seeing that, it's almost like I try and teach it that a calf raise is a pull, not a push. It's almost like you're pulling your heel bone up into your calf muscles. And what you should start to see is obviously plantar flexion, but you should start to see a little bit of inversion at the heel bone and this kind of tucking under of the heel bone. And when he was doing that, he was getting not just fatigued way faster in the calves, just in a normal like straight knee or bent knee calf raise, like fatiguing much quicker within a matter of between 5 and 10 reps, but he was feeling parts of the calves that he hadn't felt before in 3 years of calf raises. And it's because he was actually using them to create the motion rather than everything else. I have no problem with people using their toes and all of this stuff a lot at a certain stage, because you're going to just be training like all of the plantar flexors. You're just going to be training everything, which is a good option. But when you have a specific issue like an Achilles problem, and there seems like there's a bit of inhibition there, and it's obvious that you're not doing the movement in the way that we would like to do it, like that's when I will be very clear on how I want you to do this movement. I'm not saying if you're in the weight room with a group of 30 athletes, you're going to be coaching every single one to move their heel in this particular way. But this is an example of how looking at the movement, coaching the movement, understanding the anatomy, the calves don't attach to the toes. So why are we seeing the toes and the forefoot distort so much? The calves blend down and kind of become the Achilles, and which becomes the heel bone. So we want to see the heel bone starting to change shape in front of our eyes. And it's an example of like understanding the anatomy, being able to actually not just not being able to look at movement, but actually like taking the time to spend 2 minutes to look at movement. It's not that people can't look at movement, it's that they're not even trying. So deciding like, okay, if you had a hip flexor problem, I'd probably look at how your hip moved. So let's have a look at this. Understanding the anatomy, looking at movement, coaching movement, and that is what can help us drive hypertrophy and strength and improvements in force and load and all of this stuff, not just adding more weight all of the time. So that's a long kind of way around. Yeah, that's hopefully an example of someone that needed that help. I think if you're talking about like Achilles function and stuff, I am a huge fan of doing a lot of plyometric work, and in a particular way I think ultimately like our way out of a lot of these problems in the long run is increasing tolerance and is increasing load, but is helping people jump and do plyometrics and doing them in a particular way. We have a technical model there for that as well. So yeah, does that kind of answer some of the question?
Yeah, no, completely. And I really appreciate the sort of the technical model, but also the sort of technical look at how you do what you do as a method. Because I think for me, I always see the Achilles as an injury that once we diagnose that it's an Achilles or a type of Achilles issue, we tend to rush straight to the method. If we think about the causation, it's commonly going to be external load metrics, you know, spike in workloads or something to that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we very rarely look at internal reasons why the area could be overloaded or underdeveloped, or it just seems to be one of the few injuries where we don't do as much of an autopsy and create as many hypotheses as to why this could have come about. And obviously you can't always say with complete 100% confidence this Achilles issue happened because of this.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, when it's a non-traumatic one especially, but it just seems to be one of those areas where we go, what was loading looking like? Okay, straight into the method and mm-hmm. not consider maybe enough things further afield.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it probably actually doesn't even matter eventually why it happened in the first place, because now that it has happened and it's been going on for quite a while, you're just going to see avoidance strategies, inhibition, just different patterns that are cropping up. Whether this was there before and this is what happened, who knows? Whether it's a spike in load, it's almost certainly a spike in load, because it doesn't matter what pattern you have. If you sit on the couch, you're probably going to be fine. Although with Achilles, that's not necessarily the case, because some people, more inactive people, would pick up Achilles tendinopathy just going for a walk. Other people will rupture their Achilles, usually a little bit older people, and again, not particularly active, but not all the time. They'll rupture their Achilles doing the most innocuous of movement. So yeah, but I think once something, like, let's just say a tendinopathy has developed and it's been there for a while, I know if I go back to I had a very bad chronic patellar tendinopathy for 7 or 8 years when I was playing, and it didn't develop because of my movement strategies, I don't think. Actually, I'm certain about that, because it developed, I actually had a trauma to the area first, so I'm certain about that. But eventually, I ended up not bending my knee very much. I ended up not decelerating on that side. I would always like kind of fall over that side and decel on the other side. I ended up not jumping off of that side. I ended up not even walking throughout the day. I don't want to bend my knee because it's sore. I ended up doing so many things. When I was squatting, I was shifting over to the other side. Now, getting rid of pain can help to get rid of a lot of those patterns. Okay, now that I'm not sore, my body has started to use that side again. Yes, but also there is a huge amount of, like, you have actually just completely changed how you moved here, and we need to start to show you that these movements are safe and build strength in these ways again. So once the issue has been there for a while, new patterns have developed. This is why the nervous system self-organization thing, I know that's not what self-organization means. Everything is self-organization. How I talk to you is self, my jaw is self-organizing and so on. But the interpretation of self-organization is that they're just going to pick the best pattern for them. Not necessarily. The nervous system is just picking a pattern that is familiar. It's familiar with, and it feels like it's safe, but safe is not efficient necessarily or optimal. So once that issue has been there for a while, now we need to start to coach you to move in a different way again. So why it happened, who knows, but eventually we're going to have to deal with load, we're going to have to deal with mechanics probably, and we're going to have to deal with your thoughts, beliefs, emotions, and all other stuff along with that as well.
100%. I'm aware of time, and I'm sure there'll be people listening to this that kind of want more from you, and I know you've got courses and you do a variety of things. Where's the best place for people to find you?
Instagram is probably a good spot to just check out. David Gray Rehab is my Instagram, grey, and yeah, sometimes people will listen on a podcast, be interested, come on Instagram, and then like see your head and just hate you for some reason or so for a variety of reasons. So like that's a good place to say, okay, I'll see if I want to learn more or if I hate this person, and then you can either be a troll or leave. And yeah, we have a program called a foot, ankle, and Achilles program that I wrote. It is generic. It's not for any one issue. It's like, okay, here's the things that I do with people usually, regardless of, like, this is a lower leg problem, foot and ankle problem, I'll do all of these things regardless, which is restore range of motion, build strength in all of these ways, progress on to like some of what I was saying earlier, the full body work, where the foot is doing particular things, and then progress on to all this, these plyo workouts. So that's a place that people can go if they're more interested in seeing the practical side of it. And we've had about 4,500 people do that since last year. So, and we've had we've had a lot of deadly results with that. And there's a lot of coaches and therapists that have got that program. It's written from a client's point of view. But funnily enough, I think people are starting to, they really like learning in that way, because they actually can kind of go through it themselves or see, right, here's the practical stuff. Here's progressions and regressions, different phases, different types of movements. And then they start to get more interested in the theory after that. They're like, I like to have even in our workshops, it's like, let's feel it first in our own body. Let's that will help drive the understanding. And then we layer the theory on top of that. So I think that's a good way to learn. Not just, I don't mean to try and sell my stuff, but in general, like, I think we should be trying to feel certain things, understand it, and then layer on the theory on top of that. It's not that easy or efficient to learn movement by reading a book, I don't think. I think it, yeah. And anatomy, that's, I should have said that earlier. When you were asking about anatomy, like, look at how people are moving. That's a good way to start to think about anatomy, and then layer on the diagrams and the pictures after that. But let's just look at people's bodies first, and how they move and how they organize.
Yeah, cool. Well, I'm going to link out in the show notes and everything in the episode description, all of your links, so people easily be able to find it. But mate, really enjoyed today's conversation, and I really thank you for your time coming on the show.
Thanks, Andy. Yeah, really good. And thank you so much for inviting me on. I really appreciate it.
Of course.